So I'm sure in this audience there are people that have been following this very closely. Laura and I have been following it closely for quite some time, partly because we just did a trip to Israel. So we'd been watching it for quite a while before that, and then have stayed in touch with kind of what's happening. Some of you maybe not so much. You may have other things. You may have a life, you know, outside of this. And if so, so what I would like to do is I would like to talk about the most recent round of conflicts, maybe trace a little bit of a history of what has happened, and then try to talk about what does it mean? I mean, what is the impact of what's going on? So we could get into the weeds and talk about an awful lot of details, and you're welcome to ask, but fundamentally, I'd like you to walk out saying, I think I understand what's happened, and I think I have a little better insight on what does it mean? What are the implications of it? So those are the modest goals of this class. So let me start with a map of the modern Middle East. So you have Israel is a country of about 10 million people. They are completely surrounded by the Arab League. They're not all ethnically Arabs. I mean, sometimes we just use that word, but they're predominantly Muslim countries, and those countries have about 450 million people. So Israel is in a neighborhood that is quite hostile, has been quite hostile for some time. Most recent history, think 1946, post-World War, we're not going back this far in this lesson, but I just want to remind you of a brief history. 1946, World War II has ended, Holocaust has happened. There's a general consensus, broadly speaking, not amongst the Arab countries, but there is in the UN a broad consensus that there needs to be a haven for the Jewish people, a quote, safe place, a homeland, whatever it may be. And I'm leaving aside millions of details here, but broadly speaking, the UN passed a resolution to give them part of what is now known as modern-day Israel. 1947 in May, Israel declared independence and five Arab armies invaded the next day. Broadly speaking, I'm simply saying that Israel's neighbors do not want Israel to be there, and that has been true since 1947. So the history has gone up, it's gone down, and there are people on both sides that make some good points about they misbehave. No, they misbehave. But at the end of the day, Israel's in a tough neighborhood. This has changed somewhat in recent times. There is a big division between Israel and all of the Muslim world. But there are also divisions inside the Muslim world. Again, this is not a simple situation. But the one I want to highlight is divide in between the two big branches of Islam, Shia Islam and Sunni Islam. I'll discuss it briefly when we get to it. We've covered this before in other series, so I would just refer you to some of the other series that you can get online here to talk about where that happened, when it happened, what are the differences. But inside Islam, there are two large branches that began very early. I'll tell you exactly when. But Sunni Muslims are the majority. Most Muslims in the world are Sunni Muslims. Shia are the minority. Iran is a Shiite or Shia Muslim nation. They are governed in the manner of Shiite Muslims, and that is with a religious leader who is the political leader and the religious leader. Sunni Muslim nations have religious leaders and have political leaders, and they are not the same people. So there's a lot of religious leaders, but religious leaders are not their political leaders. You will have a variety of things. Saudi Arabia is a kingdom, Egypt is a different structure, Iraq is yet a different structure, etc. So you have different political structures than your religious structure. Shiite Islam, it's the same. If you want to think about it this way, it's a theocracy. So you have split between Shia and Sunni. Iran is the dominant Shia force in the Middle East. There are no other nations that are governed by Shiite majority. There are Shiites in some of the other nations, but Iran is a Shiite thing. So Iran is different than some of the other Muslims. I mean, there are many, many similarities, don't get me wrong, but there are divisions inside the Arab world as well. So we'll come back to that. So basically, Israel is in a hostile neighborhood, but there are fault lines inside Islam as well. So let's start talking about the roots of the most recent conflict. Go back not to Iran particularly, they go back to Hamas. And so Hamas is the ruling party in the Gaza Strip. Hamas is a terrorist organization, but Hamas rules the Gaza Strip. Hamas is a Sunni extremist organization. However, Hamas received huge support from Iran. Iran supported not just Shiite Muslim terrorists, but also Sunni Muslim terrorists to achieve their ends. Here in Lebanon, you have Hezbollah. So I apologize if this is really elementary for you, but it's just kind of nice to know the players. Hezbollah is Shiite. Hezbollah is a military force inside a nation, and they are too powerful for the government of Lebanon to control them. And this happens quite a bit in this part of the world. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization dedicated, like Hamas, to the destruction of Israel. And Hezbollah, however, is Shiite in its aims and its structure. It also gets support from Iran. The West Bank is run by the Palestinian Authority. A lot to be said about the West Bank, but fundamentally in our story, the West Bank is not a significant player. The West Bank is largely governed by Palestinians. They are largely Muslims, but they don't have a significant role to play in this latest conflict, so I'm going to forget the West Bank for now. This latest conflict began October 7, 2023, and that is when Hamas came boiling out of the Gaza Strip and killed 1,200 Israelis. You may remember this. This effectively, some would argue that this was a strategic mistake, that Iran wasn't ready, didn't want to do this at that time. But needless to say, there are a lot of loose cannons in this kind of a thing, and that Hamas took their opportunity, struck their blow, and that ends up pulling everyone else into the conflict. So what happens after that is Hamas begins shooting missiles at Israel. Hezbollah begins shooting missiles at Israel. What's different about this conflict? That's happened a million times before, right? And so Israel begins battling Hamas and Hezbollah. They begin protecting themselves from the missiles, and they begin sending troops in, airstrikes, of course, but they send troops into Gaza. You remember that? The Gaza War in 2024 was dominated by Israel invading Gaza, trying to eliminate Hamas. At the same time, they were trying to push back Hezbollah, mainly from the air, pushing back Hezbollah. I'll get to the Houthis in a minute. They're also an Iranian ally, and they joined in this conflict. But Iran has never directly attacked Israel. Iran's method of operation has been to use its proxies to attack Israel. And that's pretty much defended Iran from direct attack by Israel. Israel's been trying to cut off the heads of the snake without ever getting to the source of the problem. The international community would not permit Israel to strike Iran directly because they were not technically Iranians striking Israel. This has been a strategy to wear Israel down over a number of decades. So, but the Houthis, the Hamas, Hezbollah, and at that time also Syria was in this, because in Syria, I'll get ahead of myself a little bit, but you had the Assad regime. Assads were Alawites, Islam, and that is Shia. Today, there's been a change in Syria, and the guy running it now is called Shirah. He is a Salafi, in case you're interested in this, and that is Sunni. Okay, they all hate Israel, but I want you to see the distinctions between them, because there's seismic shifts happening here, and I just want you to understand the significance of the shifts in the Arab world. So what happened that's really unprecedented? This little scenario has happened many times before. And it's the Iranian playbook has been wear down Israel. Just keep sending missiles and material, rebuild Hamas and Hezbollah, have them attack Israel. Israel pushes them back, spends a lot of money, spends a lot of time, a lot of political instability, trying to push them back, and then we're going to do it all again in a few years. What's different this time is that in April of 2024, Iran fired directly at Israel. That had never happened before. So Iran, a missile from Iranian territory fired at Israel. That changed the rules of the game. What happened is Hamas has pulled, some would argue Iran orchestrated this. I would argue if so, it was a very big mistake. Many have argued that Hamas pulled everybody into this war preemptively. Whatever happened, it changed the game. As Hamas and Hezbollah and Syria and the Houthis begin attacking Israel, Israel is prevailing. Iran decides for whatever reason to get directly involved, fires a missile directly from Iran at Israel. That's a game changer because now the door is open for Israel to strike Iran. That hasn't happened before. So as we move through this from 23, I want you to see this is different than the usual war in the Middle East, okay? So February 28th of 2026, you actually see a significant strike by Israel, and in this case also by the United States, on Iran. This is epic fury, is what we call it in the United States. This happened at, we know when this happened, we will never forget when this happened, because as a group, we had crossings people in Israel. We left the country at 1 a.m. on Saturday, February 28th, which was our normally scheduled time to depart. We get to Frankfurt, we turn on the TV, and oh my goodness, a war just started back there, right? So it started around early hours of the morning on Saturday. The United States and Israel struck Iran in a big way. The reason for that strike is, well, I'll get to it when I get to the timeline, but basically, You probably remember there's been negotiation and tensions, and the question was not if something's going to happen, but probably when. And fortunately, it happened 6 or so hours after we were gone. So you see now not just Israel, but the United States as well pulled into this and striking Iran directly. Iran has retaliated, but basically on February 28th, this conflict that started October 7, 2023 has now not only pulled in Iran, but it's now pulled in Israel and the United States. So in a sense, there's been a lot of, I guess you could call it escalation, but fundamentally, that strike by Hamas has led to this, has led to a much broader conflict. Yes?
What was the 14-day war and the bombing that America did of the nuclear facilities?
That was just sort of a warm-up. So she's asking about the 14-day war, America going after nuclear facilities. When America got into this, for strategic reason, now some, we're going to get into partisan issues here. America shouldn't be in this, America should be in this. We have no business being in it. Yes, we have strategic reasons being in it. We have strategic reasons to be in this. That's not a partisan issue. It's just a fact that there are strategic concerns. Let me put it that way. The 14-day war happened in this period when the United States got in a limited way to strike the nuclear facilities of Iran. Iran has two major programs. One is a missile program. They have a lot of missiles. They're still firing missiles. A missile program, but they also had a nuclear program. When you put those two together, you have a massive strategic problem for the for Europe, for the Middle East, and even for America. So the 14-day war was America going in a limited objective way, and that was remove the capabilities for nuclear weapons, and then backed off. February 28th was moving in to do more than that, because it was apparent that after the 14-day war, Iran was rebuilding its nuclear program, rebuilding its ballistic missile program, and so that upped the ante a little bit. So those are basically rest stops on the way to this broader conflagration. So let's just walk through briefly a time frame. February 28th, you get, and this is why I think the strike happened then, the opportunity to get the Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and a large number of Iranian leaders. There was apparently, according to reporting, there was apparently a meeting, and Khamenei and some of the senior people and the Israelis and Americans took the opportunity to strike at that, and indeed removed quite a number of Iranian leaders at one time. Then you can see as you follow the days through here, I won't go through all of this, but fundamentally Iran responds, and Iran responds not only by firing at Israel, but by firing at first at U.S. assets in other Arab countries. Then Iran, as you read, I'll just give you a chance to just blitz through this a little bit. Then Iran began hitting non-U.S. facilities in other Arab countries. So Iran broadens this conflict from, again, this is a series of broadenings of the conflict. And here it broadens on Iran's part, not just to Israel, not just to U.S. interests, but even to other Sunni Arab countries in the region. We'll go on to the next weeks. Ali Khamenei was replaced by his son. A lot to be said there, but probably outside the scope of this. So he is now the supreme leader. The leadership in Iran is a high turnover job. It just, in all of the areas, Israel has made a point of removing leadership. And time and again, you probably hear of various leaderships of various organizations being removed. But the latest supreme leader is Khamenei's son. You see cyber operations happening. You see missiles being fired. A lot of things happening. And this brings us up almost to the present time when you see strikes again. What will always be a strategic interest here is making sure that there's not nuclear capability by the Iranians. That's a commitment. That commitment's been made by several administrations of the United States, both Democratic and Republican. You might argue that it's only been seriously enforced by some administrations, but it's a commitment that's been made in a bipartisan way in the United States. Israel has an existential reason to make sure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. Okay? So that's kind of what has happened. So quickly, the United States and Israel destroy the air defenses, and so Iran is completely defenseless from the air. And so Iranian leaders and Iranian facilities are being bombed with impunity. So what is Iran's response to that? Iran's response is to fire more missiles in an attempt to demonstrate that we are not defeated. From the U.S. and Israel's point of view, you have certain strategic objectives. Some would argue regime change would be an objective. Some would argue it's simply remove the nuclear capability, remove the ballistic missile capability, remove any economic ability to support all your little proxies anymore. Those are all objectives, either of the Americans or of the Israelis in this war. From Iran's point of view, they just need to survive. If you go into the ring against the heavyweight champion of the world and you lose the match, but you walk out of the ring, you won a moral victory. That's Iran's strategy, is to endure and to survive. And it doesn't matter how many Iranian citizens need to be spent in that effort. And I'll tell you why at the end of this. Why is that? That is not the way a Western nation would act, but it makes perfect sense. This is the way the Iranian leadership acts. So this is kind of how it's gone so far. Iran basically wants to do two things. They want to endure. They want to keep the regime in power. And so they've killed 40,000 is the latest number I've seen, verifiable, 40,000 of their own citizens who were trying to rise up for regime change. There's a lesson here, and that is, it's hard to have regime change when the regime are the only people that have weapons. That's true in a lot of totalitarian places. Unless someone in the military defects or turns against the leadership, it's going to be almost impossible for a popular uprising to succeed. So from Iran's point of view, yes, we had to kill 40,000 of our people, but nobody defected, and the military hasn't, there's not been a coup. No one's overturned the supreme leader. So from their point of view, we're still here. We'll kill as many of our citizens as we need to for this regime to survive. And so far, that has been successful. What's their offensive strategy? Well, you might say they have very little in the way of offensive weapons. They do. They have no offensive weapons per se, other than some missiles. What they have is economic weapons. So what you see Iran doing is saying, I can't really defeat you militarily, but I think I can cause you so much pain in the entire world oil and liquid natural gas supply that I can make you pressure these guys to back off. And then Iran meets its objectives. We're still here, and the regime is still in power. So what they've done in the Strait of Hormuz, which you've obviously heard a lot about the Strait of Hormuz, is Iran fundamentally, right now, controls the state of the Strait of Hormuz. 20% of the world's oil, you guys have probably all heard this on the news, so I'm sorry if I'm boring you, but 20% of the world's oil moves through here. And so needless to say, it's cut down to almost nothing. Because it doesn't take a lot of high-tech weapons to stop tankers from going through the strait, and it takes a tremendous amount of military effort to escort tankers through the strait. So a weak opponent can have an inordinately big effect. So what Iran is doing, they're actually doing two offensive things. This is, so the defensive thing is, hit us with all you got, we'll still be here. Do an uprising if you want. I don't care how many people, we will kill as many of our citizens as necessary. So they want to survive. But they want to shorten that if they can. And one way to do it is get the whole world to say, guys, don't you think we've had enough here? We need the oil to keep flowing, so let's stop this war. Let's just call it quits right now. That's a win for Iran. So shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, or better, controlling the Strait of Hormuz, or the Strait, excuse me, Strait of Hormuz, is their primary offensive weapon. And that is to cause the world so much economic pain that pressure mounts to just call it quits and say, let's just declare victory and end now, okay? So that's their primary objective. You've heard a lot about Karg Island. I apologize, but Karg Island is off this map. But it's up in the north, it's north of here, up on the Iranian coast. And the United States is, you probably know there's a lot going on in the Strait of Hormuz. But the fundamental idea is, this is one of Iran's two offensive weapons. Cut off all the oil, increase the pressure on the United States and Israel, and make them stop. Okay? Second strategy, that strategy is working fairly well as of this evening. It is indeed ratcheting up pressure. The press in general is very alarmist about the price of oil, very alarmist about the future of oil. In other words, there is public pressure through the press, both in Europe and the United States, that, hey, this is not good, we're losing, we need to do something, okay? The second strategy did not work very well. Iran also struck not just American facilities in all these other countries. And by the way, look at all these countries. These are all fellow Muslim countries, and they are all Sunnis, okay? But they're fellow Muslim countries, and so Iran has struck all of them with ballistic missiles, and they've struck specifically at their energy infrastructure. That matches their strategy. Not only will I shut down the Strait of Hormuz and starve the world of oil and liquid natural gas, but I will cripple my fellow Muslims from being able to supply that. The calculation there was, come on, we're all Muslims, don't make me blow up any more stuff, why don't you join in with us and let's get the Israelis. That one backfired. What you see as of today is, as of today, United Arab Emirates is very public about saying to the US and Israel, finish this. We need to finish Iran. And Mohammed bin Salman, who is, he's the incoming leader, but he's effectively the leader of Saudi Arabia, has also been public in saying, we need to take this opportunity to finish the Iranian regime. This is unprecedented. Unprecedented for something like this to happen. So at this point, Iran, instead of drawing Muslim support, has isolated itself even in the Muslim world. Now, don't kid yourself, nobody's sending troops in yet, but it has turned the Muslim world against Iran as well. So Iran is very isolated. Their proxies are not terribly effective right now. They are enduring, meaning beat us up all you want. If I'm still here, I win. And trying to speed that up by cutting off the oil supply. That is Iran's strategy. That's, in a nutshell, that's exactly what's happening here. It is a race, if you will, between the United States and Israel being able to cripple this regime and Iran being able to hang on long enough for them to just say, okay, let's pretend we won and let's leave. Okay, so it's a matter of who can outlast whom in this battle. That's fundamentally where we are. Yes?
A few other countries people have asked about, Egypt, Jordan, and Qatar.
Egypt, Jordan, and Qatar. Okay, Qatar's different. Okay, Qatar is, from an American point of view, Qatar is an ally. But then again, I want you to remember the Hamas leadership were all sitting there in Qatar during the whole Hamas war. You know, Qatar has, let's just say, put it mildly, divided loyalties. So anyway, Qatar is an ally of the United States, but Qatar has very divided loyalties. Jordan and Egypt, not so much. Jordan and Egypt were the first two countries decades ago to establish some kind of normal relationship with Israel. I'm not telling you they do holidays together. I'm not telling you they give Christmas cards to one another. I'm simply saying that from a political point of view, after 1973 war with Egypt and Syria, Syria remained very much, Jordan and Egypt came on board pretty quickly. They're part of Abraham Accords. They made, they normalized relations decades ago. So I'm not telling you they're allies of Israel, but they are non-combatants. If you remember in the war with Hamas, so Israel is fighting Hamas. Hamas has a border with Egypt. Gaza not only has a border with Israel, Gaza has a border with Egypt. And of course, there were elements in Egypt, radical elements, trying to slip weapons in. But the Egyptian government closed the fence. The Egyptian government wouldn't let any of the Hamas residents come into Egypt, and they weren't sending anything in. So Egypt and Jordan, I don't want to hit this too hard, but fundamentally, there are fault lines in the Arab world. And Egypt and Jordan have fundamentally made the calculation that it is not in their interest as a nation to support those radical elements. One thing I should tell you, that historically, Yasser Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization, I'm going back decades, tried to overthrow Jordan and take it over. The Muslim Brotherhood tried to overthrow Egypt as well. So those two nations, even though they are Muslim nations, have had their own issues with terrorists, and needless to say, are not interested in opening their borders to more of them. So those two nations are non-combatants in this. That's a good question. Okay. Meanwhile, lest we forget some other things. So today, this is the state of play today. Strait of Hormuz is closed. U.S. and Israel trying to figure out how do we alleviate this problem. U.S. and Israel continuing to hit leadership and infrastructure targets in Iran. Iran continuing to defiantly fire off missiles now and then. Not a ton of missiles being fired out of Iran, but enough to show defiance, right? So that's the state of play. From Israel's point of view, there are two other fronts. Hezbollah has reconstituted itself, meaning it built more missiles, and Hezbollah has joined and is firing missiles also into Israel. Israel's response to that is something Israel has done before, 25 years ago, is Israel is not only bombing these targets, there's a government in Lebanon, by the way. They're just not strong enough to deal with whether it's political will or military strength, and probably a little of both, not strong enough to deal with Hezbollah. So Israel would love for them to deal with it, but they haven't. So Israel is now making incursions, and they will go to the Litani River, and this will now become their demilitarized zone, a buffer, if you will. Took the Golan Heights, those of you who remember this, from Syria back in the 67 war as a buffer to keep from being attacked. They are currently in the process of clearing Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon to create a buffer zone there as well. So that operation, you'll hear about it. It's crazy. If the Iran thing weren't going on, this would be front page news. You can hardly even find this now. You know, it's crazy that this little war is, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's a big deal. So for Israel, they're fighting a war on this front as well. And our friend the Houthis. So the Houthis are, they're a problem for everybody. They have been a real problem for Saudi Arabia. They basically, Houthi separatists control a portion of the country of Yemen. So again, it's kind of like a Hezbollah. They're not a government, but they effectively control that that nation. They have been getting weapons from Iran, and they've been firing throughout this two-year period a lot of ballistic missiles at Israel. I believe they have just re-entered the fray recently in the last couple of days. They came on the scene mainly because they were hijacking ships. They were used to be pirates, then they became terrorists, and then they were well enough armed to become a real force to contend with. So the United States and Israel bombed when they went to war with Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis, and all of them were set back. Hamas is still not a force to be reckoned with at all. Hezbollah's reconstituted itself some, and so have the Houthis, and they are going to enter this. They have not entered this in a significant way, a way that really is going to alter the conflict. But don't be surprised if you see more strikes on the Houthis in the near future, because they are starting to fire missiles again. So Iran's strategy is do as much as I can with my proxies. The problem is now that Iran's in the war, Iran doesn't have the economic power, and Iran's kind of busy with missiles, you know, killing a lot of your leadership. Hard to arm your proxies anymore. So it's their effectiveness is going to be more limited than you would expect at this point in time. So that's in a nutshell, and I know it's kind of complicated, but I'm just trying to give you a thread of where this thing's been. Starts on October 7th, 2023. Hamas, for whatever reason, ends up pulling everybody into this. The Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in the north. At that time, Syria. Syria is now off the table, but Syria was an ally at that point. And then Iran made the unprecedented step of entering it directly, thinking, this is our chance, we're going to destroy Israel. Didn't happen that way, and we'll talk about that in a minute, kind of where things stand today. But as it stands today, Iran has reaped the rewards of that, so to speak, with a full-fledged attack on Iran. So Iran's on the ropes, but Iran still has some things to fight back with. One is rope-a-dope. You got to be of a certain age to remember that. Hit me as many times as you want. I'm not going to fall down. And then I'm going to make this as painful as possible by cutting off the world oil supply.
Okay. Who are the Kurds and what do they have to do with this?
So the Kurds are interesting. I got to go back to another map here. The Kurds are players, but not in my thread. Does that make sense? So Kurds are an ethnic group of people who are not Turkish and they're not Iraqis, and they are split into those two countries. So just a little bit of history. World War I was a turning point. Think 100 years ago, just a little over 100 years ago. Before World War I, this whole Middle East was Muslim under the Ottoman Turks. So Turkish Muslim rulers at that era happened to be ruling all of the Muslims, basically, okay? They joined Germany in World War I. Bad move. So when they lose, America, but mostly France and Britain, I just want to blame them because they were mostly responsible, come into this part of the world and start drawing country boundaries. That's just never a good idea. And the country boundary happened to go right in the middle of the Kurds. That's just called, why don't we just have trouble for the next 100 years? And that's exactly what has happened. So you have Kurds have been minorities in both countries. They've been vocal minorities. They would like to have their own nation. I'm really, really simplifying this. So if you know a lot about this, you realize I'm simplifying this. But fundamentally, they would like to have their own nation, and neither country wants to let that happen. So the Kurds have been a problem for Turkey. The Kurds have been a problem for Iraq. The Kurds, I would characterize it as the Kurds seeing a moment of opportunity, if you will, to pursue their aims. They're not major players in the Israel versus Iran and Iran proxies, but they are indeed a factor here. It's a little bit of a side issue, if it's fair to say that.
Okay, little history on Iran. Have they always been Shia, including when the Shah was the monarch? And does this go back to the Persians?
Good question. That's a multi-thousand-year question. So let me think of a multi-thousand-year answer that's not very long. Yes, they are descendants of the Persian Empire. Okay, so you're thinking you're looking at the Persian Empire. I think Daniel, we just talked about Daniel. And so the Persians overcoming the Babylonians in 539 BC and the Persians ruling, massive kingdom. Cyrus the Persian, still studied today, till Alexander the Great shows up and the Greeks defeat them. But a massive kingdom, and that's in Iran, basically. So Iranians are not Arabs. I'm speaking with a broad brush because it's 2,000 years later. But fundamentally, they're not Arabs from Arabia. They're Persians. Now, today, there's a lot of mixing, okay? But broadly speaking, they are Persians by descent. So before 1979, there were a lot of Shiites, Muslims in Iran, but Iran was ruled by the Shah, which is a more of a Sunni setup, meaning your supreme religious leader, the Ayatollah, is not your president or your Shah or your king or whatever. So it's more of a Sunni setup in a Shiite country. 1979, the revolution against the Shah by the first Khomeini, his name's actually different, it just sounds the same to us, but Khomeini, he overthrows the Shah and institutes a Muslim nation that is a Shiite theocracy. So in recent times, you had a more Sunni leadership, a non-religious leader. And then in 1979, you get the Shiite theocracy. I'm going to call it a theocracy. It's not exactly that, but that's basically what it is. So the roots of this go back to pre and post 1979.
Okay. Houthis, are they Sunni or Shia? Are they Muslims?
Yeah, they're Muslim. They're Sunnis, I think. They're kind of a little bit of a different breed in the sense that they're a little bit of an outlier. But yes, they're in this game. They're allied with Iran. They're trying to destroy Israel. They also are, I'm going to call them radicals. I'm not trying to be inflammatory with this. The reason I want to call them radicals is they also hate Saudi Arabia and would like to overturn them as well because they're not Muslim enough. Does that make sense? That's kind of the thinking. Which is why Egypt and Jordan don't want certain radical elements in their country because they try to overthrow them, even though they're Muslim, but they're not the right kind of Muslim and they're not Muslim enough.
So?
That all the time, happens in the Middle East all the time. So I'm not telling you that they have bigger fault lines with each other than they do with Israel. Everybody hates Israel, right, if you're there. But we also don't really get along at the family gatherings with each other as well. I want you to see their fault lines there as well.
So Sharia law, you might talk about that a little bit. I have several questions. Do the Shiites follow it? Do the Sunnis follow it? Are there differences?
Yes, so this is kind of a common thing. Doesn't matter if you're Shiite, doesn't matter if you're Sunni. I mean, it does, but it doesn't. I mean, speaking at 30,000 foot, it doesn't matter. Sharia law, The Quran is a totalizing system, meaning the Quran not only tells you your religion. We as Christians sometimes, and we probably shouldn't do this, the Bible tells me about my spiritual life, and the government or my homeowners association or somebody tells me about my Monday through Friday life, okay? Right, so we kind of split this a little bit. That's not the case for Islam, Sunni or Shiite. Now, painting with a broad brush, because not all Muslims are devoted Muslims, there are secular Muslims, but basically, the Quran has a set of laws that govern all of life. That's called Sharia law, as it's been interpreted by the religious leaders and so forth. It's a big corpus, but fundamentally, the Quran describes how you should live every aspect of life. That's called Sharia law. You see Sharia law enforced in Saudi Arabia, which is a Sunni country, to one extent or another, and you'll see Sharia law enforced in Iran, in a Shiite country as well. They're not always identical, but fundamentally what you're asking, Sharia law is fundamentally a Muslim thing, not just a Shia or Sunni thing. Good question.
Okay. Why do you think the U.S. and Israel struck Iran in February?
I think they struck in February when they did because they knew we had flown out. I feel like they were waiting for the Crossings group to get out of Israel. No, in all seriousness, I'll just tell you the reporting that I have heard. I can't guarantee you it's correct. We were watching it closely. Our last day was Friday, the 27th, and we knew that the United States was continuing to negotiate. We knew that Marco Rubio was going to be in the Middle East on Monday or Tuesday, March 1st and 2nd, right? And so we felt like, okay, we're going to play the negotiation out a little longer, but it sure looks like something is imminent here. According to the reporting that I have heard from a variety of sources, I cannot guarantee this is true, but I will say that it rings true because this is what happened, is that Israeli intelligence was so good that they knew that Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and a large gathering of dozens of key regime leaders would all be at the same place at the same time. Apparently, this is according to reporting, I can't personally guarantee this is true, the United States knew that they were waiting for this. Israel wanted the flexibility to strike when they had the opportunity. My opinion is it does ring true that that was an opportunistic strike. That was an opportunity to really move the game ahead, knowing that the U.S. president had said the week before, very disappointed in the negotiations, this doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And so I think it was an opportunistic strike, which was going to happen at some point. They just had the opportunity to, in some sense, decapitate the Iranian regime. So I think that's why it began on that day. That's my opinion based on the reporting. I could be wrong, but I would say in hindsight, you look at it, that is indeed what happened.
You may not want to comment on this because it broadens it substantially, but I have several questions about Russia, Putin, and China, and Xi Jinping, and whether or not they're involved and what their roles are.
Yes, so let's talk briefly about that. So fundamentally, there has been an axis, a loose affiliation that's pretty much allied against the U.S. You could argue allied against the West, but the West has its own fracturing, right? NATO, U.S., Europe, there are fault lines in all these alliances. Fundamentally, the U.S., as the leading power in the world today, has a rival claimant from China, also to some extent from Russia. Vladimir Putin just wants to reconstitute the Russian Empire. They've given up dreams of ruling the world for now, but they would like to reconstitute the Russian Empire. And so China and Russia, who didn't used to be friends at all, think Nixon, Kissinger, 70s, they were big time rivals. Now they're allies, along with Iran and along with North Korea. Now, to be fair, they also don't send each other Christmas cards, but their interests are aligned. From China's perspective, whatever Iran wants to stir up and whatever you want to make the United States spend money on and munitions, that's great because Xi Jinping wants to take Taiwan before his rule is over. Vladimir Putin wants to conquer Ukraine and would love it if the Europeans and the Americans would get out of the way, go fight your own war in the Middle East. So they were allies of convenience. Iran was shipping a lot of oil to China. And so China was getting really cheap oil by violating the U.S. sanctions. What do they care about U.S. sanctions, right? And so they were getting really cheap oil. So you do have this axis of evil kind of a thing going there with those nations. What's been interesting here is what Russia and China haven't done. They are giving intelligence to Iran. They are shipping some weapons to Iran, but they fundamentally haven't weighed in a significant way here. So I think what Russia and China, this is my opinion now, what Russia and China are doing is let the U.S. expend their energy, let them expend their munitions, et cetera, there, and we will get back to our agenda and send Iran a condolence letter saying, yeah, I know we were allies, but gosh, I just didn't see your email. And so didn't come help you, okay? Right. So I think that's what's going on there. They are allies of convenience, if you will. And it's now not exactly convenient to be Iran's ally. So good question. So let's talk about, so that's the state of what's going on now. At least you know this is what Iran's trying to do. This is what U.S. and Israel are trying to do. And this is everybody's war plan. And we shall see how it plays out. What I want you to see, though, that's important in this, and I know some commentators have talked about it, I want to spend a little more time on it, is that the fundamental failure of the West, I would argue, in dealing with Iran for many administrations has been a failure to understand a radical ideology. We keep expecting Iranian governments to act in a rational way, meaning the way we would act. When you get secular leaders like Saudi, like the Sunni nations, they're religiously Muslim, but their rulers are not clerics. They're not ayatollahs. In other words, they have political ambitions as well. Consequently, they can be reasoned with in the way we in the West like to reason. Self-interest, what's good for your people, that you respond to sanctions, economic things hurt you very much, and so we sort of play ball together. We may throw a lot of elbows, but we sort of play ball. That's not true of Iran. Iran is a theocracy. They don't have political rulers. They have religious rulers. That's the difference between Shia Islam. So I want to talk a little bit about Islamic end times theology. In other words, you might go to any other nation in the world and say, if we fight and I have to put sanctions on you and your credit's going to get bad, your people are going to starve, if we actually shoot at each other, we're both going to end up losing here. We're going to destroy infrastructure. It's going to take you 20 years to rebuild. Seriously, do we want to do this or do we want to negotiate? Most people respond with, okay, negotiation's better than fighting, okay? That's not true here. Fighting is part of the plan. So I want to tell you a little bit about the eschatology. This is Islamic eschatology, but I want to talk specifically about Shiite. So these are quotes from the Quran. What I want to tell you from this quote is, according to the Quran in the end times, and this is going to sound a lot like Jewish and Christian, because I want to remind you when the Quran comes about. So you know when Jesus was here, you know that when the New Testament was. Muhammad was born in 570 A.D. In 610 A.D., 600 years after Jesus, he begins to receive these visions, which is what these are. The Quran is made up of these visions, right? A sura is a chapter, but it's a vision. He has these visions from 610 to 632 AD, and he dies in 632. So a lot of this is going to sound like, man, that's just eerily familiar to the New Testament. It's 600 years after the New Testament, okay? So yeah, it does. But the idea is that there is going to be a judgment. There's going to be a trumpet sound. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? A trumpet sound and a judgment day and a settling of accounts. And except in this one, the Muslims are the good guys and the non-Muslims are the bad guys. When that happens, there will be a judgment day. And in judgment day, everyone's deeds will be weighed. Muslims will be weighed. Non-Muslims, be a quick weighing. You lose, okay? And so it's all about your deeds. Are you being faithful in doing what you're supposed to do? On that day, this is, again, I just want you to get a sense of the idea of judgment. There are going to be people that are judged, and you are going to be given the book in your right hand, if indeed you're good, in which case you'll be live a pleasing life in a lofty garden, eat, drink, wholesome appetite, blah, blah, blah. And the one who's given book in the left hand would say you're going to roast in hell. Okay, so that's a short version of that. So it's very deeds-oriented, right? But there is the idea of a judgment, and there is the idea of retribution against the enemies of God. That's the end time scenario. There's going to be a deceiver called Al-Dajjal. This is virtually identical to the Antichrist of Revelation. This is interesting. This is from like the 1600s. This is a painting. This is Al-Dajjal. So the Antichrist, he's riding his horse that's described. You can read his description. This is Jesus, Isa, or Jesus, who is going to defeat the Antichrist. This veiled figure up here is a figure that's important to Muslims and extremely important to Shiite Muslims, called the Mahdi. He's the head guy. And so at the end times, Jesus will come back and he will defeat Al-Dajjal, and the Mahdi will come with him, and the Mahdi will be this great messenger of God. This is classic Shiite eschatology. So in other words, there needs to be a battle between the Shiite Muslims, the good Muslims, and all the unbelievers, the West, the great Satan, America's the great Satan according to Iran, that are allied on the bad side. Jesus will be on their side, and they believe that it's their job to get this going now. They are going to be fighting in this battle, okay? So this is part of the end times. This goes all the way back to the Shiites. I'll hit this really quickly because we don't have a lot of time. But this is Shia Islam. Sunni Islam has a different succession. So when Muhammad died in 632, the Sunni-Shia split, like right at the beginning. Sunnis said, we're going to pick a leader, but it's not going to be a relative of Muhammad's, and it's not going to be a religious guy. We're just going to get together and we're going to vote. Mail-in voting allowed. Yeah, they're just going to do a vote, right? Shia said, no way, it's got to be a relative. And the first relative is Ali. Ali, and so he gets passed over. While he's at the funeral, they pick a leader. Okay, so you see this split early on. Ali has two sons, both of whom are killed by other Muslims, Sunni Muslims. And Hussein was killed in 680 at the Battle of Karbala. He's killed by other Muslims because they said, no, you're not going to be in charge. And so from 680 on, there has been this split. Shiites say, your caliphs or imams or successors of Muhammad are not legitimate. These are the legitimate ones, and there have been 12 of them. And the 12th guy, when he was young, in 874 AD, did not die. He was taken away. He is called the Mahdi, the rightly guided one, and he is going to come back when it's time for the end times, and he's going to participate in the battle. You saw him in the picture there. He's going to participate in the battle, and he's going to be the one who ushers in Judgment Day and defeats all of the enemies. The difference in this eschatology and Christian eschatology is Christians aren't going to fight. The Lord will fight the battle. We do not take up an AK-47 and go try to kill the non-Christians. That's not Christian theology at all. That is Shia theology. No, we're part of this thing. Let's get this thing going. So this is a good little chart. This is about the Mahdi. I'll let you read that for a second. But he's basically going to come at the end. He's a messianic figure, and he's going to bring justice to the world, restore the true religion, Islam. And you can see some of the predictions about him there. But here's what I want you to see about him. According to Shiite eschatology, he's a 12th imam. So if you've heard of 12er Shiite Islam, anyway, that's the 12th imam who's going to come back. And you can read here a little bit about him. But what I want you to realize is the Mahdi is going to return to establish divine justice that he has been in hiding. They call it occultation. He's been removed until the appropriate time. And there is this idea that the true Muslim leaders, Ayatollahs, the Shiite state, the Muslim state, is the caretaker of the world to bring the Mahdi back. And so they are here to pursue the interests of Islam. The state is a temporary vessel for divine preparation. If you're the Ayatollah, you see what's happening in the Middle East not as a political issue at all. You see it as ushering in the end times, and you are going to win. You're not going to win because your airplanes can shoot down the U.S. You're going to win because the Mahdi's going to come, and the skies are going to open, and the trumpet's going to sound, and Allah, God himself, is going to come down and usher in the end of the world and say, well done. I was waiting for somebody to start this thing off. Seriously. So they see themselves as the guardian of divine justice, and Iran's perceived sacred duty is to prepare the ground for the Mahdi's return. So Iran's leadership, this is not what every Iranian Muslim believes, right? I mean, people have more or less devotion. This is what the Ayatollahs believe. That is why you could say, what a crazy strategy. Hit us with everything you've got, and we will still be here, and we'll kill as many of our people as necessary to survive. And you go, that is not rational. No, not by our standards, it is not. It makes perfect sense if this is how you see the world. This is why I think the West has such a hard time dealing with Iran, is a failure to understand the motivations. If you look at what's happened, this makes sense. This is the motivation of the Iranian regime, is this is ushering in the end times. Consequently, I don't see, personal opinion, I do not see a negotiated settlement. If you're Iran, the only reason that you negotiate is to stop the bombing so you can go build some more nuclear weapons, because this is your commitment. And I don't say that with any polemic, I'm just saying you should expect that. What did they do after the 14-day war? Bombed all the nuclear things? Start digging up the centrifuges and enriching uranium again? You go, that's crazy. No, it's not. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Just need to understand that. So let me put a bow on this and just see what happened. I wanted you to see who are Iran and its allies. Because Iran, strategically, this has not gone well for Iran. Iran and its whole network of proxies have pretty well been dismantled. The jury's still out as to whether or not Iran will survive and live to rebuild over the next 50 years or so, right? They're playing a long game because it's an eschatological game. But if you think about it, Syria, the Assad regime, was overturned, and the current regime is not even mildly friendly to Israel, but they are non-combatants. Syria is out of this. Lebanon, Hezbollah. Hezbollah's back, but Hezbollah's much weaker, and Israel is now going to go in with boots on the ground and kind of clear that out. Gaza, Hamas is no longer a factor. There are Hezbollah in Iraq. They're firing a few missiles. They're not a significant problem. The Houthis were beaten down and had a lot of their infrastructure destroyed. They will be back. And Iran had a nuclear program. They were the regional key players. They are not the regional key players today, although they are choking the Strait of Hormuz. But now even their Arab allies are like, we need to make sure they can't continue to export terror, which is remarkable. So strategically, between October 7, 2023 and today, while Iran is still in this fight, we'll see how this plays out. Fundamentally, they are in a much weaker strategic position today than they were in 2023. Strategically, that was a mistake in October 7th of 2023, and Iran would agree with that at this point in time. How it plays out to go forward, all of them will be weakened, but will they be destroyed? And if they are not be destroyed, then they will be back, because we're playing out this eschatological endgame. So that brings us up to today. I can't tell you how it's going to end, but I will tell you the Middle East is not going to be the same after that it was before. The Shia-Sunni split, that fracture is way deeper. The Sunni nations have been fired on by Iran and are calling for overthrow of this. So it has upset the power balance. Iran is weaker. The Sunni nations are closer to being allied to the West than they have been before. And so no matter what happens out of this, the power balance in the Middle East has changed in the favor of the United States and Israel. I hate to say that too loudly because, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but fundamentally is more favorable to the U.S. and Israel. Question.
For those who would like to pray for Israel, what would you tell them to pray?
Yeah, my prayer for this is for God's hand to be in this, that good would triumph over evil. I pray for the people of Iran who are being murdered and oppressed. I would pray for all the people who are suffering in the midst of this war. I'd pray for good to triumph over evil in the leadership. But I would pray specifically for the West and Israel. Israel's a democracy. When these things happen, the biggest problem a democracy has is unity. In the United States, you notice that we're fairly disunified. If you're on one side of the political aisle, this is a bad war. If you're on the other side, it's a strategically good war. If you're in the press, you're critiquing whoever's in power. Same is true in Israel. This is Netanyahu's war. No, it's not. This is a war for survival. You see what I'm saying? Unity in a free country, in a democratic country, the ability to speak freely means that you can become disunified. Totalitarian government, you may feel disunified, but you are going to toe the line, right? So I would just pray for unity of purpose amongst the democracies, and that God's hand would be in this. But in all sincerity, let's pray for every single civilian, whatever their nationality, because they love their children too, and they're suffering. So let me end with a prayer for them. Heavenly Father, I pray that you alone are wise. We don't see a way through this, but we know that you work in every circumstance for your goodwill. Father, we pray that your hand would be in this, that it would be guided to your purposes, which we can only glimpse. We simply pray, Lord, for comfort for those who are suffering, whoever they are. I pray, Father, for the children of this world that are hungry, the parents that have lost loved ones. Lord, I just pray that you would bring this war to an end. I pray that evil would indeed be defeated. I pray, Lord, that Jesus would come quickly and that you would do justice in the world. And until that time, we remain faithful. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you guys very much.